Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh with our legal roundtable panel and a full plate. There's continued Ferguson fallout, a couple of constitutional issues, and a $42 million tug of war between city public and charter schools. In studio to discuss these and other issues are attorneys Bill Freivogel, professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor and director of the Career Center at Washington University. And Mike Wolf is the soon-to-retire dean of the St. Louis University School of Law. We'll find out when that's going to happen, Mike, a little bit later. But first, I'd like to begin by acknowledging and congratulating Bill Freivogel. He is named a recipient of this year's prestigious American Bar Association Silver Gavel Award for his online St. Louis Public Radio series, Law, Justice, and the Death of Michael Brown. Congratulations, Bill.
Thanks a lot.
Yes, and you get all the Ferguson questions.
and there are plenty of them. we can whip through a lot of these, I think, fairly quickly, but I wanted to start with the latest concerning Prosecutor Bob McCullough, case before the Court of Appeals right now. People are trying a rather circuitous route, it seems to me, to ultimately wind up in his ouster. They want a special prosecutor. If they get that, then the grounds are set for his ouster. Mike, our guest, how do you see that?
I've got a news flash. Prosecutors are elected, and Bob McCullough was elected. You'll see the same issue in the city. I think you're going to talk about that shortly. Well, by the way, we're one of the – I don't know if there's any other country that's crazy enough to elect prosecutors, but we also elect judges all over the country. So what do we know? And so it's up to – you know, if you don't like what the prosecutor, the kinds of decisions he or she is making, there is the electoral process. And it takes quite a lot to disqualify somebody in terms of a direct conflict of interest. And so they've got a steep hill to climb.
But isn't there something on the books, and I've forgotten for the moment what it's called. I mentioned that a special prosecutor has to be named before they can take it to the next step. There is a law on the books which would allow votes.
It's 106.220, and that's the statute they were pointing to, saying – it basically says that the prosecutor failed to act. But it's a really – And this is what the circuit judge said. He described it as a very hard standard to meet. He said they had not met it.
This is the investigation into Darren Wilson, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's now being appealed. I think the a three-judge panel of the Missouri Court of Appeals just heard the appeal last week.
Yeah,
and
right.
So, I mean, I kind of agree with Mike, though. I think it's going to be very tough for them to win on this case.
Any insight, Bill?
I don't think they're going to win. And, you know, like Mike says, prosecutors are elected. McCullough was elected. I mean, there are a lot of things you can say about McCullough being very pro-police and not having prosecuted police officers before in situations involving use of deadly force. But on the other hand, you can also say in his defense that he actually handled this grand jury in a fairly open and transparent way. It's not very often that grand jury transcripts are released as they were in this case. So that can be said in his behalf.
Some of the complaints that were made against him were, one, that he knowingly allowed false testimony, that, two, he allowed the defendant, Darren, to come forward and present his justification defense. Mm-hmm. And they said that's not typically done when you're seeking an indictment. You know, there's this statement that a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. And so they're saying, you know, you should have gotten an indictment, and you did all these other things to basically protect the officer who was charged. Having said all that, you know, we do have a system that's supposed to be, you know, trying to do the right thing. And so I know some people just wanted an indictment and wanted this person charged, but I don't know that that's always the best thing, to just get an indictment, you know. But obviously reasonable people can disagree about this.
The problem with that I agree with your analysis there, is that you don't indict somebody unless there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. That's what our basic
and process is about. And prosecutorial discretion.
It certainly does, and that's what brings in the electoral. I don't think that there was any secret when Bob McCullough was running for office that he was well supported by the police, and he supported police activities within a certain range of his discretion.
Well, wasn't it determined after the failure to indict that a lot of people obviously didn't like it, but that he didn't do anything wrong? He did what he was supposed to do. I mean, wasn't that determined?
I think you can argue that he didn't do anything wrong. You know, as one of the claims was he allowed this, you know, a fairly outrageous, person to testify who was clearly not, you know, telling the truth, and so you know he shouldn't have allowed that. And but it was he had a fairly good defense for that. There was a question about was the last minute change in the instructions to the grand jury, was that proper? The change. Which sort of grew out of some conversations actually that Mike and I had, and then I wrote a story about the change made it easier, would have made it easier to indict Wilson. So it was a little hard to say that was something that was improper.
They point to things in the the fact that Darren Wilson wasn't really cross-examined, where they say, but witnesses that would have going against Darren Wilson were cross-examined. But we keep coming back to it. The grand jury is not just to get an indictment; it's to do justice. Mm-hmm. And usually, things like grand juries, and we have all these defendant rights. Here, Darren Wilson was the defendant, and he needs to have those same rights of a defendant.
We should point out that it's before the Court of Appeals now because the lower court sided with the McCullough side in the case. All right. Well, while we're talking about prosecutors, let's get into that Jennifer Joyce case. It's somewhat different. The Police Officers Association wants a special prosecutor in the case of the indictment of a former police officer who was charged with having killed someone while on duty 5 years ago. How is this different? How is it the same?
The activists want the same thing for different reasons. So both sides want Jennifer Joyce off the case and have a special prosecutor. I haven't found any good reason that anybody said why there should be a special prosecutor. I mean, from the standpoint of the activist, she is prosecuting a police officer, which, by the way, she has done on occasion. And from the standpoint of the Police Officers Association, as they well know, the prosecutor has a great deal of range of discretion, and she thought the evidence justified it. I don't know what the new evidence was, but it was sufficient for her to take that to through the process. I believe that was a grand jury.
I think the best defense was what she said, which was, if both sides don't like me, I must be doing something right. And mm-hmm. I think there's something to be said for that. There's this long period of time that's troubling. I mean, what is it, 4 years?
Five years.
Mm-hmm. I guess the argument is, it was with the U.S. Attorney's Office. There's some suggestion there was new evidence. I mean, those are all troubling facts, but I don't know what they are right now.
But the United States Attorney's job is not to decide whether or not the police officer murdered somebody.
Well, that's a good point.
The United States Attorney's Office is going to decide whether to charge somebody with violating the person's civil rights. And that's a whole different set of questions. I can very well see that a Department of Justice, the United States Attorney, would not pursue it as a civil rights case, but that a local prosecutor would pursue it as a homicide.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened here. And by the way, the flip of that is true as well. Sometimes there'll be a killing by an armed member of the police or somebody from the government, and the federal government will take it on as a civil rights violation, even though the local prosecutor says it's not a homicide.
Right.
I mean, one thing that was a little unusual about this case was that the federal government seems to have done its criminal investigation first. I mean, it's usually the other way around. Mm-hmm. But I take it, I mean, from what Jennifer Joyce has said, it was really only fairly recently that they have looked at this as a criminal matter, and they got this new evidence. I mean, I take it that the officer's DNA is on the pistol found in the car with the dead fleeing suspect.
And the deceased person's DNA is not on the pistol. Right.
Which would seem like might be important evidence.
Just as a technical point, who would determine in this case that there should be a special prosecutor? Where does that determination come from?
That usually goes to the court, but
she could on her own decide that. But otherwise, yeah, I think you would go to the courts, but I got to believe that's a big standard. You're overcoming the democratic process. This is our elected prosecutor.
I mean, there was a bill introduced last year in the legislature to enable there to be special prosecutors in cases involving police use of force. Mm-hmm. And that bill got nowhere. Yeah. It didn't pass. I mean, so it's only in the extraordinary situation that you would get to that. And, there are problems with special prosecutors. I mean, we only have to remember Ken Starr to recall that mm-hmm. it doesn't always work out that great.
Right. Before we take our next break, one or two other things concerning Ferguson. Bill, I'll turn to you on this. I think it's a total of 5 reporters who are essentially off the hook now with regard to charges that were filed in connection with the Ferguson disturbances. Can you fill us in on that?
Well, the two national reporters, they dismissed the charges against them. They're the ones who were in that, I think it was at McDonald's.
Yeah.
And they were told to get out, and they were sort of stalling, being a little bit slow, and then they got arrested. Wes Lowery was one of them from the Washington Post. The First Amendment doesn't protect your right to be someplace that is, been, say, a closed establishment, mm-hmm. So there was an argument to be made for the prosecution, but it wasn't really a very smart prosecution, nor was it a very smart arrest. I mean, mm-hmm. If you went back and you looked at the origins of all the Ferguson story really blew up after that happened. After those arrests and after the police start showing up in their militarized outfits and everything, I mean it's that's when the story just went really national and international.
If you want your story to go viral,
arrest some reporters.
Go arrest some reporters. rule of coverage.
There was some suggestion. The other reporter was this guy Ryan Riley from Huffington Post, and I think on both of those sites and the Washington Post site, there was a suggestion that there was an agreement, you drop the charges and we'll sign no suit.
Yeah. There were settlements in all of these cases. Yeah. I think the other 3 reporters were foreign reporters, weren't they? Or at least a couple of them were.
A couple of them were. Uh-huh. And the one little bit worrisome thing about that case that got settled was that I don't think we really have details of what the settlement involved. Sometimes settlements aren't public, but one would sort of hope that they would be in this case.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take our break now. We'll come back in just a moment, continue our legal roundtable discussion. We'll do that with Mike Wolf, who is the outgoing dean in the St. Louis University Law School. Also with us in studio, our regulars Mark Smith and Bill Freivogel. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation. Mike, again, I'll turn to you on this because I know you would like to at least acknowledge it. Two St. Louis University law students had some success in defending 2 accused violators in conjunction with the Ferguson Troubles. Must be pretty smart kids.
They are very smart kids, and they apparently did a very fine job. I wasn't there, but they got acquittals for their clients on these failure to comply charges arising out of these demonstrations, and then there was a third case where the prosecutor, about 40 minutes before trial, dismissed the case, but put together a memo saying they'll be really guilty. But well, I guess the response to that is, if they're really guilty, then you should really go to trial.
Well, this has to be something of a rare occurrence for law students to get involved in court proceedings.
Our students do quite a bit of in-court work for clients, and I think that it was appropriate that the clinic received a national award for the work that they did around the Ferguson and related issues over the past, since 2014. They were actually involved in those municipal courts long before Michael Brown's death. And so they really kind of hit the ground running with some of the abuses that they had observed that that are now being, I think, tackled by various committees and everything. I've stayed back as dean and admirer, but I also give some advice that the hard part of change comes when people start agreeing with you, because then it's details, and now we're in the details. So it's nice to have those opportunities for our students to actually go to trial and have a real trial and call witnesses and make arguments. I think
this
it's
is
fabulous.
Something that is it still Rule 13 in Missouri that allows? I think fourth semester law students, but they're under the supervision of a lawyer. So it's not just law students going unsupervised, although I'm sure yours are extraordinary, don't need much. But, you know, they all are getting supervised. I don't want people to think, oh, the Missouri Bar is just letting anyone go in and represent people in court now. It's still
John
very
Ammon,
structured.
Yeah, really a very, very fine clinical professor at the law school. He's, in fact, the McDonald Professor of Justice in American Society. He was there supervising them, and I'm sure that they were well prepared and did a fine job.
And this is part of the trend in higher in legal education, more practical kind of training of law students.
Right. But from time to time, you hear of people deciding that they're going to defend themselves in a trial, people with no legal background.
You're always allowed to have a full for your client. That's exactly right. Yeah. So if you want to, if you don't have any legal training, you want to represent yourself, go ahead.
Good luck.
System loves it.
And again, this last Ferguson-related, and that's something of a stretch, but Bill, I'll turn to you with regard to legislative action, with regard to police use of force, which is an issue that came up following the Brown shooting. How has that changed anything?
Well, it's changed. Missouri law was really it was an antiquated law in that it was out of step with what the constitutional standard was for when police can use deadly force to stop a fleeing felon. And so last year, the Missouri legislature didn't succeed in passing new legislation. I believe that they have now. And the new legislation has mostly puts Missouri in line with the rest of the with the constitutional standard and with a lot of the other states' laws. It says that if a person, a police officer, can only use deadly force if a person who is suspected of committing a dangerous felony is fleeing. It's not as there would be two criticisms from sort of the liberal side that you might offer. One, and I'm sort of relying here on one of Mike's professors, Chad Flanders. So one criticism is that the officer doesn't have to show that the fleeing felon suspect is dangerous at the moment that the shooting occurs. So, I mean, think about the Michael Brown situation. So Michael Brown's fighting with Darren Wilson over the gun. So he's a dangerous felon suspect. Hmm. By doing that, then he runs, and is he still a dangerous? I mean,
He's running away.
Of course, he does turn around, but is he still a dangerous? So I think Chad would have liked to see some language that said, you know, presently a dangerous felony suspect. And the other thing is, you don't have to under the Missouri law, you don't have to like give a warning or try to use some other less deadly means to stop them. Some other states have those requirements, so it's a pretty good law. Maybe it could have been better, but it's a big improvement, I would say.
And of course, the legislature is also a move that more citizens can carry guns now.
Yeah, sure. You don't even have to have a license, right?
An armed society is a polite society. However, I have to say that as a graduate of the NRA rifle safety course many years ago, and as a person who owned guns when I was a kid, most people are bad shots. And the assumption that we have that having a whole bunch of people with guns, say in a school or a shopping mall or someplace, is going to do – I think the value of the gun goes down substantially once you draw it out and pull the trigger.
We're not all Roy Rogers. We can't, on a galloping horse, shoot the gun out of the bad guy's hand.
I remember those scenes. They were quite inspiring. I didn't know how to ride a horse very well, and I was a terrible shot. So I have to say I didn't do either of those things.
I'll tell you something that really annoys me sort of repeatedly about the gun advocates' claims is, you know, you had Speaker Richardson saying, well, we've protected Second Amendment rights of Missourians. There's no Second Amendment right to carry a gun without being licensed. It's just not the case. I mean, every state could pass a concealed carry law, and that would be in compliance with the Second Amendment. Even Justice Scalia said so in writing the Supreme Court opinion about in the individual right. So this idea of the Second Amendment, like anything that you do to give people more chance to have guns everywhere, and anything you is in advance of the Second Amendment, and anything you do to restrict it is restricting the Second Amendment, is just a fabrication.
So two things in this legislation. You know, one was this adoption of this a stand your ground,
right.
Which means if I'm out on the street and we get into an altercation, and I can easily get away from you, I don't have to do that anymore. So that's, I mean, that was the Trayvon Martin case in Florida, was stand your ground.
It worked out so well there.
Yeah. And the other thing is we've talked before about the castle doctrine, the idea that your home is your castle, you can protect your home. They're extending these castle doctrine rights to certain invitees in your home. So, for example, a babysitter is the example that's been being used in a press a lot. The other thing, and I meant to look at the legislation before today, but I know under the old legislation, under the Castle Doctrine, it said anyone who was defending their home was immune from a lawsuit. So that means Bill's breaking into my home, I go to shoot him, but because I'm a bad shot, I hit Mike. I think Mike can't – I can't be prosecuted. And Mike's just – minding his own business, walking his dog, and happens to get shot. I also think he can't civilly sue me, and that seems to be a big deal to me.
Let's take a call from Tom in Afton, who wants to get into the level of force discussion. We'll take his call and then move on. Tom, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thanks, Don. So this weekend in Washington, an armed assailant was stopped by the Secret Service at the White House with a single shot. And I understand they do that because they want to be able to interrogate that person and see if it's part of a conspiracy or if there are other people involved. But what it brings to mind, you know, here in St. Louis at the epicenter of this police force discussion, is that so many of these police shootings, the police have used 7, 10 shots, the whole magazine. And those of us who grew up with and around guns recognize that they're shooting to kill often. And I have been following the blog post of a retired police officer that says that is the current training. They don't say it explicitly, but with a wink and a nod, they all reach an understanding that if you're going to shoot, you better kill. And, you know, as an ordinary citizen, I find that extremely objectionable. And I wonder if this new use of force law will do anything to help that situation. What can we do as an ordinary citizen to kind of change that police culture?
You know, thanks, Tom, for the call.
If I could just say something on this, I was at a Ferguson meeting, you know, one of the committee meetings they had for about a year, and somebody basically asked the same question of Dan Isom. Are police officers trained to shoot to kill? And what he said was, no, they're trained to neutralize the threat, and neutralizing the threat means you don't try and shoot for the hand or you shoot for body mass because you got a better chance of hitting it, not because you're trying to kill the person, but because you're trying to hit. And I think also adrenaline gets going. They're not sure if they've hit or not, so they're trying to – but I don't think there's an intention, nor are police officers told, you should shoot this person until they're dead. That's not what they're told. But if you're going for body mass, you're more likely to – seriously hurt somebody or
if
kill them.
If you really want to stop him, you shoot for the head. But as Mike just suggested, you're probably going to miss.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's why center mass is the target of choice in that. Don, thank you for the call. Did anyone want to add to that? Okay, let's move on to some other things. I know, Mike, this is something that that you want to talk about and have been thinking about, and that's the City Public Schools seeking to recover $42 million from sales tax money distributed to charter schools. They're saying essentially the money belongs to them, does it?
It's a very complicated historically based analysis that I have because I was involved back in 1998 and before when a number of people, including representatives from the business community from Kansas City and St. Louis, educators, lots of people were involved in putting together a piece of legislation that set the stage for the settlement of the desegregation case, both in St. Louis and in Kansas City. And as part of that, one of the things that we were trying to do was to get more money available under the regular school aid formula for St. Louis and for Kansas City, and also to distribute money on the basis of impacted poverty to other districts. So one of the mechanisms for getting more money to St. Louis was to get the property tax rate raised. There was a way to do that, and it happened a little bit because they put that overlay district on top of it. But they also wanted to have a local tax increase. And the polling showed quite clearly that people were not going to support a property tax increase, so they went for a sales tax, which by the statute was converted to an equivalent amount of property tax. Have I lost you yet? Anyway.
You're getting there.
I'm getting there.
Fortunately, you've already been before. Right.
When the case was settled, of course, that was part of the settlement because the financing mechanisms didn't take place until there was a settlement. And the school district got the sales tax and the additional property tax. It drew down more money from the state foundation aid formula. But also in the same legislation was provisions for charter schools, which provided that a charter school would have the state aid per pupil plus the local effort. And the local effort, if you look at that legislation, included both the property tax that was imposed on the citizens of St. Louis, but also the sales tax revenue that was converted to an equivalent property tax. So that went forward, and I think there was a great deal of resistance at the outset after the settlement to the development of charter schools. There were threats to sue people who were going to start charter schools. That all kind of calmed down, and then some charter schools got up and running. The legislature, a new legislature, I might add, quite indifferent in some ways to the needs that were addressed in the 1998 legislation, rewrote the foundation aid formula. Because the foundation formula for financing schools was key. The amount of money you got was dependent for many districts on how much your property tax rate was. That got to be more and more expensive to fund because more and more school districts around the state were raising property tax rates so they could draw down more state aid. So the legislature said, in effect, let's change the subject. Mm. Let's define adequacy, and we'll make sure that every district has an adequate amount of money to spend. So in a sense, the local tax effort became somewhat irrelevant. And so the law still says, and the state law is explicit about this, that the charter school gets the amount of state aid plus their share of the local tax. And really the principle that we were following and espousing back in 98 was the money should follow the kid. If the kid goes to the county, to a school district in the county, the money follows the kid to pay that county because the county residents don't want to be told that their tax money is educating kids from the city. And the county, by the way, in the new interdistrict transfer program that occurred after the settlement, they've negotiated a rate different than what they had under the DSEG program. A somewhat lower rate, but more consonant with the amount of money available, plus the fact that you've got to provide for transportation. So, but the other thing is that if you got a charter school, which they didn't then, but there certainly are now, there are 10,000 and some children in the city of St. Louis who go to charter schools. So that's a huge percentage of the kids, and those kids include a lot of African-American kids. Right. So when you have this dispute between the charter schools and the St. Louis public schools, you're really fighting about some really scarce resources. And if the public school district believes that it was promised this money in the settlement agreement, it should go after the state but right. not after the money from the charter schools, because the charter schools are getting, I think, exactly what the state law provides. So I think they should all get together rather than fighting with each other and go to the legislature and say, look, whatever you guys think is adequacy, it isn't working in these areas. As a matter of fact, I think school districts across the state are suffering because the priorities of the legislature seem to be cutting taxes rather than funding public education.
If the city school,
have I lost
public,
you yet?
If the public schools won the case, it would put several charter schools out of business.
Well, if you take it as that the money was misdirected to the charter schools, then under the law, the charter school has to pay that money back in 12 installments over the next year.
Uh-huh. Well, under what law?
Under the state law. For financing charters. So if they get the wrong amount, because, you know, the money that comes to charter schools and, for that matter, to school districts is dependent upon their enrollment, as reported on their average daily attendance figures. Well,
but wouldn't the state have to go after the charter school rather than the city school? I mean, it seems like you got three parties. Well, so the city schools sue the state because you gave the money to the wrong guy. Give us our money. And then the state would have to choose to sue the charter school, or at least that seems to make sense to me. Does it?
I think you're right. I mean, that's one way to look at it, is that, well, the money appropriately went to the charter schools, but also, and I don't know what the financial details are in the settlement agreement, but there were some financial guarantees. If those haven't been met, then certainly they have a claim against the state for that. But, you know, they funded this adequacy thing, and that became unaffordable. So you may have noticed late in the session that they changed the formula to redefine adequacy. And the governor vetoed it, and they overrode his veto.
I would just say that the legislation passed in 1998 was part of a very big compromise that was trying to accomplish a lot of things to improve education. One was to keep the desegregation program going. One was to get charter schools going because it thought a little competition for the St. Louis public schools would be a good thing. And I think the key thing that Mike said was that it was understood that the money would follow the student. So the students who went to charter schools, the local money would go with them. The students who went to the county schools, the money would go with them. And so I think that that's why this lawsuit is a little questionable.
We'll see how that plays out. We have another story that's semi-related to all of this. We'll get to that in a moment. I do have to take another break. We'll do that now and come back and continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Mike Wolf, Mark Smith, and Bill Freivogel. While on the subject of charter schools, a young black student who was attending a charter school in the city of St. Louis, his family has moved out to the county. You're familiar with the story. Under the deseg agreement that we've been talking about, black county students, which he now is, cannot transfer into the city. White students in the county can. Black city students can transfer out to the county. This is being called unconstitutional by the family who's suing to get the kid back into the city school. Does it smack of unconstitutionality to any of you?
It certainly is race-based. And one of the things that, you know, the desegregation program was approving under federal court orders the use of race as a criterion for whether you could go to a particular school or not. Well, now the case is settled. There is some kind of continuing jurisdiction of the federal courts. But on the other hand, it seems that it is, in this case, discriminatory to say, well, you can't – if you're a white kid in the county, you can go to a St. Louis public school, including a St. Louis charter school. Because remember, charter schools are public schools. They're all supported with public money. But if you're an African-American kid in the county, you can't go to a St. Louis public school. Well, there are some very good charter schools. There are some very good St. Louis city schools. I think the city schools have done well. And, you know, this competitive environment is I think, one of the signs of success was seeing billboards around town saying, send your kid to a public school in St. Louis. They never did that 20 years ago. But back to this case, I think they've got a very serious lawsuit here. I think the race-based exclusions, and by the way, the money has to follow the kid, because now Maryland, is it Maryland Heights?
Yes.
Where the kid lived? Yeah. That local money and their state aid has to come to the charter school. It doesn't get to come from the St. Louis City District people. So that's another factor that has to be played in.
I hope nobody's giving a pop quiz on some of the complexities of these two issues, because they are, in fact, that.
I mean, you can understand why the settlement agreement had the provisions it did, because the idea was we're trying to desegregate the schools here, right?
So we have to use race to
so,
fix
so
that.
So race
right.
is something that's considered. But then when you see this situation playing out where it was, you know, totally race is excluding this kid from the school he went to and enjoyed, and that's actually contributing to desegregation, it doesn't seem sort of crazy.
Yeah. Another case here that is interesting, and that's the case of Rachel Johns, who wants to run for the Missouri House of Representatives. This, too, is relatively complex, but she was, as a form of protest, did not register to vote. And now her opponent in this race is claiming that she is not qualified to vote because let's see. What is the election Three violated years. Equal protection rights? She was
free speech rights, wasn't it? Too free speech rights.
Yeah, exercising her First Amendment right to protest here by not registering earlier. The opponent says you've got to be politically active for 2 years before you can run for office. Thoughts about that, Mike?
It was very interesting because the Supreme Court of Missouri split 4-3 on this.
Yeah.
And they upheld the requirement that you be a registered voter for 2 years before you can qualify. Now, think about that. What that really is an incumbent protection provision. Because now that they've upheld the exclusion of Rachel Johns from the ballot, the incumbent, Representative Peters, now has no opponent. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that the suit looks at is the interests of the resident voters in having a choice. And so there is an equal protection element as to the candidate, but there is also kind of a, political process, kind of due process argument on behalf of the residents, as well as her participation. I don't make anything of her saying I didn't register because it was a protest. Who cares? She did fit the durational residence requirement, but she did not register to vote. Well, voter registration is a relatively new phenomenon. I don't remember how far back it goes, but I remember in the 80s, a guy down in the boot heel I know told me that they had really taken the art out of politics with this voter registration stuff. So I know it's a lot more recent than the constitutional provisions.
Yeah, well, I think it's a really, as Mike points out, it's a 4-3 decision. Sounds like maybe if Mike were still on the Supreme Court, it would have been 4-3 the other direction. Uh-huh. I thought the dissent by Laura Stith was awfully strong. And I didn't think really the majority held the state regulation to a high enough sort of burden. But that's 4-3 counts.
But the United States Supreme Court might be asked to take it.
Well, I was.
But in their current posture, they only got 8 justices. That's it.
Right. Well,
it can be 4-4 on that one.
Our friend Roland,
Dave Roland, yeah,
is handling this case for Ms. Johns, right. And he basically says he's going to take it to the Supreme Court.
Yes, so, and I think he should.
Yeah. He's going to try to take it to the Supreme
Court.
There's a 1 in 1,000 chance that anybody's case can get to the Supreme Court, but hey. It's always a good try, and I think it's an important issue.
It's interesting.
From the standpoint.
It's an interesting
case.
The other thing is that the phrase is used as qualified voters,
not registered voters.
No, qualified.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, back in the day, because the majority opinion by Judge Russell cites the 1875 Constitution, which I think is where that started coming up. It might have been before that. A qualified voter after the Civil War was somebody who swore allegiance to the Union. It had nothing to do with registration. So I'm not so sure that the Confederates get to win this one.
While we're talking about the Supreme Court, I'm sure all familiar with the fact that Donald Trump has done something quite unusual, and that is announced potential picks if he is elected president for the U.S. Supreme Court, and includes Ray Grunder, who is a judge here in town. What do we know about him?
Well, he was a year behind me in law school, so he seems like a nice guy. He's old enough. Yeah. He's younger than me, but he's still old enough, yeah. And I think he's viewed as a nice man, a good judge, a conservative judge. So I don't think think it's a real honor for him to have his name thrown out as a potential Supreme Court judge. That's a big deal when you're a judge, and that's a real honor for him. And I think it seems like it's a political move by Trump. This is not
a
legal issue.
Will you draw that conclusion, actually?
That's why they call me Mr. Trump. That's right, yeah. So, you know, to signal to the conservatives, you're not going to have any problem from me when it comes to nominating judges.
You know what's interesting about that? Two things. One is, first of all, there's obviously a list someplace of judges who voted right. Mm-hmm. And I mean right. And so because they didn't vet 11 people all at once. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they were busy doing it while they were doing other things in the campaign. So, and the problem is that what that does is that, first of all, what if I'm a conservative judge and I'm not on the list? What about me? Mm-hmm. Well, it really becomes a pander list. So how can I get myself on that list? I can vote right on all these cases. And I think it also diminishes the judges who are on the list because it implies that they have a political orientation that is consonant with the prevailing notions of politics as opposed to being the kind of neutral arbiters of what the law and Constitution say.
It undermines the legitimacy of the court,
does.
I think.
I think absolutely it does. And so I don't think that this was, from the standpoint of a fair and impartial judiciary, a very good development. I
agree.
Want people auditioning for the Supreme Court by the way they vote.
Done before?
Pardon?
Anything like this been done before?
Well, informally people kind of have run for the Supreme Court by being in line.
I mean, I can't think of candidates saying, here's who I would put on there, but I'm much younger than you two. Well, you probably have better
memory. But, I mean, when there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court, there's often stories before the president nominates someone.
Sure, yeah.
So it's not that outlandish, I don't think. But, I mean, clearly this, from a political standpoint, this is sort of made the conservatives happy. It's also interesting, I think, Mike, you mentioned this in an email, that these are not necessarily all Harvard and Yale and Stanford graduates. Yeah. And so on a Supreme Court that is all Harvard and Yale, it'd be nice to have a little something different. I think Grunder, if he were I found him personally to be a nice person. I don't think he's an Antonin Scalia. I think that if he were nominated by President Trump after what's happened, the Republicans have done to Merrick Garland, I doubt that he would be confirmed if the Senate still has 40-plus Democrats.
You know, speaking of the politics of this, I'll have to look at that list again and see where all the judges that he has named are from and whether they're spread geographically.
They are.
You know, to have that political advantage.
I think they also probably make a line with certain states that need to be won.
Exactly. That's mm-hmm.
I think
that's
that was
exactly
your point.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. Okay, the transgender issue. We're familiar with the fact that President Obama has acted unilaterally, if you will, along with the Justice Department, Department of Education, on the transgender issue. And one of the things that was said in the order that was passed out was that transgender people are now a protected class. Does that ring true in your mind? Would this be the case? A protected class,
I guess the interpretation of Title IX, you know, so Title IX is the
right.
is the Civil Rights Act.
Anti-discrimination.
Anti-discrimination. We all sort of think of it in terms of women's sports, but it's much broader than
sure.
that. And so their the Obama administration's interpretation of that provision is that it protects a transgender person's right to go to a restroom of their, you know, what they currently, the sex they currently claim. And I think that that's within the administration's purview to make an interpretation of Title IX. And And then, you know, what goes along with that is that any educational institutions getting federal funds, those funds are at risk if they do not follow the federal government's interpretation of Title IX.
And I think one of the things that this has brought up is the speed with which people are taking on these issues. You know, people started talking about gay marriage back in the early 90s because I remember well and thinking about it and I go, whoa. And that changed a lot because a lot of gay people came out to their families. And so we all got a real sense of that these are our family members, these are our neighbors and so forth. And there was a real, even though it happened relatively quickly, probably the quickest social change that I've seen in my lifetime. Well, I don't know if the public has really processed the transgender issues in that with that same length of time or that depth of thought or with even any real information about this. And so while I agree entirely with the substance of what the policy ought to be, I don't think you change things just by decree. I think judicial decisions and administrative interpretations have to have a certain amount of acceptance, consensus, if you will. I know there's not a consensus on gay marriage, but there is a consensus, at least enough of one, so that people will accept it as a valid interpretation. I think there's a whole lot of people who are kind of confused about this, and maybe we needed some more of that Orange is the New Black and a few other things where there are really very appealing transgender characters who will, in effect, educate us. Maybe even Caitlyn Jenner can educate us about what all this means. So it seemed to have come rather quickly. I'm happy for the people whose rights are being protected. I think it's going to cause a lot of political backlash.
Right. But I think if I'm a person, I'm saying I can't wait for the rest of society. I need my rights enforced. And also, you know, Bill talked about Title IX, but under Title VII, which is the law that regulates employment, you know, one of the big cases was the Price Waterhouse case, which created a kind of a hostile work environment. The idea of sex harassment because this woman was not acting like a woman should, according to her colleagues. And they said that was enough to have sex discrimination. So you've already got this notion of gender in there, and there have been some decisions. So to answer your question, is it a protected class? The statute doesn't say gender, but I think the courts are coming to that belief that it is.
Right.
That's certainly the trend.
Is this going before the Supreme Court? We have 30 seconds left. I mean,
It could get there.
It could get there.
I think they'll stall.
I think they'll let it kick around in the lower courts for about as long as they can. Because, you know, it again.
Because of the reasons you suggested.
The reason, yeah, exactly.
As you say, things like this have to steep for a little while before there is a public acceptance. Mm-hmm. Well, let's end it on that point. There's lots more to talk about, but we don't have time. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us. Mike Wolff, great to see you. No specific retirement date yet, but we'll stay tuned.
I am still large and in charge.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing you again on this program right here. Bill Freivogel, thank you. Mark Smith, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Being with us. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.